More students are back in brick and mortar class this week as parents keep a close eye on that school system COVID tracker. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect. Thanks for listening. Just ahead on today's show, everything you need to know about COVID in local schools, as we speak with education reporter Emily Block of the Florida Times Union. Get on the line now, parents, and anyone with an interest in this, it's 549-2937. Join us. Then later, speaking of kids, we'll tell you why a group of young people from around the nation, including a child from Florida, are suing the federal government over its failure to combat climate change. These children say the government is stealing their futures. We'll look at the lawsuit. It's all detailed inside the pages of a new book called As the World Burns. But first this hour, the latest on the coronavirus pandemic. The Florida Department of Health recorded its lowest numbers of cases and deaths since the spring in Monday's report. That's good news. Now, that said, we want to give you a little context into this. The statistics released by the state also accompany a sharp plunge in the number of overall test results. But here are the numbers. The state recorded 738 additional new cases of COVID yesterday. That's the lowest tally since June. And there have been 5 additional deaths around the state. Now, amidst those numbers, more Duval County school students transitioned back to brick and mortar class 5 days a week, beginning Monday. At the same time, the Duval schools made some recent changes to their dashboard that lets parents know which schools have active cases of COVID-19. Duval Schools has done an admirable job of transparency with all of this, despite some interference and pressure from the state of Florida not to release this information. Parents, students, and teachers still have lots of questions. Right now, we're working to get some answers. Emily Block covers education for the Florida Times Union, and she's on the line. Hi, Emily. Good morning.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Always good to have you on the show. As we talk COVID and schools with Emily Block of the Times Union, what are your questions? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. Emails to firstcoastconnect at wjct.org, tweets to @MelissaInJax, and our Facebook page is open. Well, Emily, high school students, including one of mine, went back to class 5 days a week this week in Jacksonville. At the same time, you have been reporting on changes to the COVID dashboard for the Duval County Public Schools that parents check pretty regularly to see where the coronavirus is active in schools. What's new this week?
Sure. Well, a lot's new, as you said. So today, or Monday, marks the first day that all grade levels that opted for in-person learning are attending school 5 days a week instead of a staggered schedule like it's been before. So this was the first week that every grade level from elementary school all the way to high school has had daily school, daily in-person learning instead of a hybrid schedule. And that's part of the school district's overall plan. It was a bridge to transitioning. Not every school district in Florida got to do so. There was an executive order back in July from the Florida Department of Education commissioner that said that in-person learning should have a daily option. And he called it a mandate. Of course, our reporting later expanded on that and said that it really isn't a mandate, but at the same time, it could be tied to district funding. So districts felt this pressure to comply. Duval Schools was one of the few that didn't immediately go every day. They got a waiver from the Department of Education that let them do it as a hybrid. So they did it in phases and now marks the end of that hybrid plan.
Right. And so kids are either in class 5 days a week or they're in Duval homeroom or they're doing Florida virtual school, correct? Those are the two buckets.
Right. Yeah, correct.
And it's still too early to know how this is going to play out. But what are you hearing so far from parents and teachers and kids about how this is going so far?
Right. So a trend that we were seeing as the hybrid schedule was progressing along since the beginning of school was that according to Duval School's own tracking system to their dashboard, elementary schools were being hit a little bit harder than anywhere else. And of course, anyone could put those dots together that elementary schools were the only ones going to school daily. Middle and high schools were staggered. So there, of course, are concerns that now that everyone is daily, will there be a rise in cases for the other grade levels? And those are things that we're watching, but it's really too soon to tell.
Too soon to tell, as we talk with education reporter Emily Block of the Times Union. What are your questions about protecting children from COVID in schools as more students are back in class now 5 days a week? We'll go to your calls in a few minutes. It's 549-2937 to join us. Let's shift over to St. John's County, Emily. We're getting anecdotal reports from parents in the Ponte Vedra area telling WJCT News that they hear that multiple kids have been sent home with fevers and symptoms that they think could be COVID. How do the two districts compare, Duval County versus St. John's County, in the number of cases and how they're handling transparency and getting information out to parents?
You know, it's hard to say because every school district is a little bit different as far as what they're doing. There's never a perfect apples-to-apples situation. I know that Duval County has been really trying to be transparent. That's the word of the day, right? I mean, they have this COVID-19 dashboard that the Department of Health told them to take down, told them that they couldn't do for a while, and there was pushback there and a fight until now that there is a dashboard up and live reporting active cases relating directly to schools, in-person schools. And we're not seeing as much of that in St. John's. It's by no means the darkest toll. I mean, we're still getting information, and of course we're hearing from parents as well. We're hearing these anecdotal situations, such as students being sent home with fevers, but it's not exactly the same. It's hard to do an apples-to-apples.
We are hearing, too, that every member of the Nice High School dance and freshman volleyball teams are in quarantine this week due to possible exposure to coronavirus. And we need to note something incredibly sad, Emily. A 12-year-old girl in our area, in Atlantic Beach, Mayport area, has died from the virus. She was a virtual student at Mayport Coastal Sciences Middle School. Elizabeth McNew, age 12, was moved to intensive care on September 19th, and she has passed away. Her family is devastated. They were not able to be with her as she died alone, a 12-year-old girl. And, you know, reading this account is just so awful because the family says they had been taking every precaution against the virus that they could. And Mr. McNew, the husband, and one of his children, his son, tested positive. They both had minor symptoms, but then Elizabeth became very, very sick and had to be taken to Wolfson Children's by ambulance. She was so sick, and she didn't make it. This is more proof, as if we needed it, that kids are not immune to this virus, that they can get sick. Along with adults, they are at risk. And what's so frightening is that this family was taking every precaution and that she was studying in virtual school. Her parents had decided to keep her at home to protect her, Emily.
Yeah, no, it's horrible, Melissa. There's really no other way to describe a situation like that. And it just shows you how much is still very unknown about this virus and its spread and its ability to seep into everything. I know a woman who today, she said, please get tested, even if you're not feeling any symptoms, because she, as a precaution, you know, got tested before visiting her parents. And it's a good thing she did because she was asymptomatic. So who knows who that could have spread to, who would have been more susceptible than her and maybe not have been so lucky to be asymptomatic. So it just goes to show, and it's why we're still, why Duval County is still observing a mask ordinance. It's why we have to take every precaution, but it's hard. No one really knows exactly what that looks like.
Yes, the mask mandate for Duval County has been extended by the mayor for another month, and it is in effect in the Duval County schools. As we speak with Emily Block of the Times Union, what are your questions about COVID in schools? Let's go to some calls now, 549-2937, to join us. Erin is in San Marco. Hi, Erin. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to comment, I have two boys in middle school, and they're already telling me that the barriers that they've created in the classroom are starting to break down, get kind of destroyed, and I did expect that to happen, but, you know, we're only in the second month of school, and they're just returning full time, I think, 2 weeks ago. So it is a concern of mine. Is there even a budget to replace or fix those?
Right.
Barriers.
Thanks, Erin. Emily, can you answer her question and explain to everyone exactly what the situation is in classrooms in terms of barriers and all the other protocols?
Yes. So what our caller was referring to are these plexiglass partitions that school desks have. And the school district spent about, I believe it was a $4 million project with money from the CARES Act to install these in classrooms. But from the get-go, we've been hearing complaints and issues with them. Teachers are talking about how, well, they're cardboard and they're this like plexiglass with a cardboard frame, a thick cardboard frame. So number one, how do you clean them and how often are they cleaned? Number two, like what happens if they get wet from that cleaner or from a faulty air conditioner leak or something like that? Number three, some of them were too tall for the students to see through or over because of where the cardboard piece hits their eye view. So now teachers are doing these modifications and some of them are cutting them and like reattaching them or finding a better way for them to lay on the desk because they were falling over. So nothing is perfect. The school district is saying they're doing what they can to mitigate compared to what other school districts are doing. And this is kind of, an industry standard if we have such a thing for handling COVID-19 in schools. We are seeing these partitions and barriers in some form or another pretty much all over. I mean, I'm seeing them across Florida schools at the very least. But, you know, they're not perfect by any means. I don't know what the school district's exact plan is for replacing them. I imagine it would also come from CARES funding. The school district has been very quick to say if a teacher runs out of cleaning supplies or something like that, that is covered and that they will be covered and not to feel like you have to buy something yourself. So I would hope and imagine that this also falls under that, but I don't want to say something that isn't completely true. So
right.
It's something I'll look into and try and get a better answer for. But yeah, we're seeing those issues all over. They're not perfect by any means.
Right. 549-2937. Your question's answered right now about COVID and schools. Anne Marie is in Mandarin. Hi, Anne Marie. Good morning.
Yeah, hi. Good morning. Hope you're all doing well.
Yeah.
I have a high school senior, and he's returned to full-time school this week. I am so happy for him because our kids need to be engaged. They need to be physically engaged. They need to be emotionally engaged and socially engaged. And I think the last thought for me is my son's not playing on the computer anymore, and certainly not as much as before class started again. And I'm very thankful that the school district is doing what it can to get our kids back into school.
Thanks, Anne Marie. And I think thousands of parents out there are echoing your exact sentiments. Emily Block, as you report, last week, the Duval County Public Schools said about 4,300 students requested to switch from Duval homeroom, learning at home, to in-person learning, brick and mortar school. So the majority of kids have gone back to class. Is that accurate?
Yes, from what we can tell so far, the majority are back to in-person learning. And remember, only about a third had opted for virtual school. And there could always be outliers, like maybe someone pulled out from Duval County entirely, you know, but from what we can tell, the majority is in person. And what our caller was saying definitely rings true. I mean, I talk to young people all the time, and so many of them have voiced just their excitement to see their friends every day and not have to balance like, oh, which schedule are you on? Am I going to see my friends on this day, or are they on the other, you know, schedule? So they're excited, but they're also concerned. I mean, they're also realistic, and they're wondering, especially seniors, they're wondering, am I going to get a prom this year? Am I going to get a traditional graduation ceremony and things like that? But at the same time, they're also wondering, am I going to potentially bring home a really scary, potentially life-threatening disease home to my parents or grandparents or people that I love? So it's really complex.
Yes.
I'm sure we all are realizing for ourselves as well. But yes, there's a lot of excitement. It's almost like the first day of school all over again for some of these students, where they get to see all of their friends at once and all of their teachers at once. But there's also, in the back of their heads, they're also a little concerned.
Right. We had thought last school term that that group of seniors had it really bad. They were robbed of all of those traditional things like the prom and walking in cap and gown. But this class of seniors may have the same situation. We just don't know how this is going to progress. That said, you wrote a story that appeared in USA Today, Emily, an analysis of the state's positive COVID case count among Florida kids. It has declined through September after a peak in July. College-age adults are driving the spike in cases, not school children, you found. And that, you say, shows the results of mask wearing, social distancing, and other measures that people have taken on their own to try to tamp down this virus. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Right, definitely. So what we're seeing across Florida, and even nationwide, and again, it's not, you know, this is an ever-changing thing, and some of the results surprised us, but what we're seeing is that primarily it's college age, it's young adults that are being the most affected during this, like, school season so far, but that could change at the drop of a hat, and of course, like, the data is going to change, because at the time that we were collecting these numbers, Duval County Schools, for instance, it was still hybrid. So, of course, they had elementary schools more impacted, but that was an anomaly. So we don't know if that will stay an anomaly or if that will alter as things across the state change. For instance, Broward Schools is looking at when they'll go back. Miami-Dade is looking at when they'll go back. So these numbers could totally change. But for the time being, it seems like college-age young adults are the most impacted by the virus since school has started.
We're getting emails and tweets for you, Emily, about Elizabeth McNew, the 12-year-old Atlantic Beach girl who died last week of complications from the virus. Actually, she died this week, I should say. She was a virtual student at Mayport Coastal Sciences Middle School. There is a GoFundMe set up for her family to help with expenses. People are asking us, did Elizabeth have any pre-existing health conditions that we know about? Or was she perfectly healthy when she became sick? And we do need to stress she was in virtual learning. She was not going to school, physical school. Do we know anything more about this?
So what we know is that Elizabeth was 12 years old. She was going to virtual school. We haven't been made aware of any pre-existing conditions. I also want to emphasize something that a health reporter colleague of mine has been saying, and it's that even if someone had pre-existing conditions, if they have been living their whole life with pre-existing conditions and this virus is what ended up killing them, it's still on the virus. You know what I mean? So I think while of course we all want to know, well, oh, is there something else? Was there an underlying cause? If it is still caused by the virus, it is the virus that killed this child or really anyone else that could have been impacted. This is a general statement. So to my knowledge, I haven't heard of any underlying conditions. We aren't completely sure, but I haven't heard of any. But that said, this is still a 12-year-old. So
yeah,
I think we can, yeah, like it, I, yeah.
Yes.
I'm going to leave it there.
It's just, yeah, it's devastating. We're speaking with Emily Block of the Times Union about COVID and schools. We'll go to a few more calls in a moment. The number to join us is 549-2937. Meanwhile, comments coming into the show from Facebook. Susan writes, we're all in a big experiment. How are kids sent home if a classmate tests positive? How do districts handle that, Emily?
Sure. So every district is handling it a little bit differently. Of course, that's the pattern we're seeing. But they are working with their local Department of Health. Duval County, for instance, works in conjunction with the local Department of Health, and they work with their local contact tracing nurses with their own health segment of the school district. And they are contact tracing. It depends on exposure. There's so much to it. I'm not going to get into all the intricacies. A lot of it is available online, either on our reporting as well as on the Duval Schools website. But they define exposure in different ways, whether it's a percentage, whether it's an amount of time exposed to a person that is tested positive. They contact those people, and then if a person is directly involved, they will be contacted directly, and then the number is updated on the Duval Schools dashboard. And that's one of the changes that happened to the dashboard yesterday that we noted. They pushed back the deadline of how late the dashboard will be updated. Before, it was by 8 p.m. approximately. Now it's by 10 p.m. approximately. The school district is saying that's because they want people to find out directly from them if they've possibly been exposed before they find out from a ticker online.
Thanks for that. Here is a question for you on Facebook from Johan. How can we get charter schools to also report their COVID numbers, he asks. There are a lot of kids in charter and parochial schools around this area. So what do we know about those statistics?
Right. That's another thing that we learned yesterday in the dashboard updates. Previously, Duval Schools said it was working with charter schools to see if they could eventually incorporate their numbers into their dashboard. Right now, it only has traditional public schools that are under their jurisdiction. Yesterday's update revealed that they will not be doing that, that it's just too complicated. They said that there's too many intricacies as far as how each charter school is handling it. They're all handling it very differently, and it becomes too complicated to interweave that into the existing school district dashboard. That said, charter schools, some of them are publishing their own results. Some of them are making it very publicly facing, but not all of them. And that's a work in progress. And that's obviously concerning. These are numbers that people want to know. These are numbers that people are using to decide how they're going to treat their day. So it's concerning. It's something the school district has said it has worked on, but they can only do so much. And that really is going to come down to charter school to charter school.
Yeah. So bottom line, parents just need to take the reins. They need to get in communication with their school, their child's school, and get as much information as you can get. It's 549-2937 as we speak with Emily Block of the Times Union about COVID and local schools. Carol is in Arlington. Hi, Carol. Good morning.
Hi, good morning. I was concerned about my grandson's school. He enrolled in Duval Virtual Instruction Academy, and he is now regretting that decision. He was a student at Sandalwood High School, a junior, but he has not received his courses yet from Duval Virtual, even though he applied in July. And now it's too late for him to go back to the brick-and-mortar school because he's 6 weeks behind. Mm-hmm. So we're having that problem, which really hasn't been talked about much in the media.
Okay, Carol, thank you for that. Emily, let's talk about that bucket of students, like Carol's grandson.
Absolutely. Well, first off, I'm sorry to hear that he's dealing with that. That's, of course, so frustrating and disappointing. What I can say is that with Duval Virtual Instruction Academy is a full-time virtual school. Melissa, I heard that right, right? It was DVIA, not Florida Virtual School.
Okay, I think that's cool. Right, yeah.
Because, you know, they're, that makes it more complicated, too. Florida Virtual Instruction is a full-time virtual school, but it's not within the district. So those students, either they enrolled in time to have a traditional full-time schedule, or they're going to do it flex school, and maybe there would be some leeway if there are too many students, and, like, maybe the schedule will get pushed. But for Duval Virtual Instruction Academy specifically, that is a district-run virtual school. I had heard about there being delays, and I think we'd reported on some of it in the very beginning of the school year, as far as just too many students and figuring out who gets what class. But I didn't realize that it was still pushing on to now, to 6 weeks in. So it's definitely something I'm going to look into. Because I agree, it's a problem and something people need to know more about.
Here is
so I appreciate that caller.
Sure. Another comment on Facebook. What about homeschooling kids? Can they participate in neighborhood school activities?
Yes. I don't completely understand that question, but if they're it depends on what that person meant by homeschool. If they are a Duval homeroom students, but they're still enrolled, which means they'd still be enrolled in their school, then yes, they are still eligible to participate in any sort of extracurricular, club, band, sports, athletics, any of that. Yes, that's part of the deal. Prom, et cetera, all of that. They're still a student at that school. If they are now a full-time homeschool student, if they were pulled out of the district, which is what homeschool typically means, then, I mean, they're no longer within this school district. They're not going to be a part of, like, a prom or something like that or an extracurricular. But, you know, there are always exceptions as far as I know some schools do programs with their local community where they, if they don't have a prom otherwise, they could participate in the local, their local district. But, yeah, that really, that depends on the specifics of that question.
Okay. David in St. Augustine. Go ahead, David. You're on the air.
Hey, I have a part-time job delivering to schools in Duval County.
Uh-huh.
And, like the cafeteria portion of school. And, been kind of really inconsistent, with the mask wearing and all different policies at different schools. I go to almost every school in Duval County and some schools will let me unload through the regular delivery port, and then some schools have to go through the front office, and some schools won't even let me in. So it's, I just wanted to kind of report the inconsistency that I've kind of seen and holes in the system there.
Yeah. David, thank you for that. Emily, let's talk about this whole other population of people, people that work in the schools or in and around the schools, and how they're interacting with this.
For sure. Those are really worrisome inconsistencies. I'm glad they brought that up. One thing we do know is that, of course, the Florida entering phase three has added some confusion to the bill. People are wondering, well, oh, like, does this override everything that my city is doing? And the short answer to that is no. Even if the mayor had not extended the mask ordinance locally, Duval schools had already made it clear that they plan on continuing mask wearing and things of that nature. So masks are still mandatory in Duval schools for students and employees and anyone else. Of course, that makes it messy for, you know, outside parties, for visitors, for delivery, for buses, for everything else in between. So, yeah, it's messy. But the short answer is they're supposed to be wearing masks according to district guidelines. There's supposed to be social distancing when possible. That's probably why that caller is seeing some schools where they want him to come through the front office and some where they want him to check in and some where they come to him. And I think part of that is just because of, like, miscommunication of trying so hard to interpret the guidelines perfectly.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the road ahead. For the time being, all of these safety precautions remain in place in local schools. And from everything we're hearing, even though that caller gave us some pause, there is a real effort to get kids masked up, to keep barriers between children, to just do whatever is necessary to keep the virus low down. What happens at the end of the first 9 weeks, Emily? What's the road ahead for local schools as we head into the fall and the winter? Because epidemiologists keep warning us that we could see another big uptick in cases this winter, which is worrisome.
It's scary, right? So right now the plan is to push on and keep doing what we're doing. The initial trial when school started was this hybrid plan, and they were going to see how things were going, and as long as things were trending up, they were still going to push to migrate everyone participating in in-person learning to full-time 5 days a week of school. So from what the data is showing, the school district and the school board decided that yes, we can still push on and do this, because those dates were contingent on if, you know, knock on wood, something bad had happened, if the data was way worse than it was. Superintendent Diana Green called those numbers of COVID-19 cases at schools manageable, quote, and she said that based on what they're seeing, like, it was totally, pushing on to full-time was an option that they still felt comfortable doing. So now that's happened, and now we're going to see what happens when everyone is in school daily. And from there, I'm sure the school district will keep track on numbers and reassess as needed, but there's no additional contingent in the calendar yet. as like, for example, when we migrated to full-time, there was that contingent of depending on how numbers look, depending on how things are going. That doesn't exist anymore. We hit that barrier. We've passed it already. So now I guess it's a sit and wait.
Yeah. Any final advice for parents that have had anxiety about this and teachers?
It's really hard. We're all dealing with it and hearing about it. Please continue to contact me and your local media, especially now because of, as we just heard with that caller, visitors aren't being let in because of COVID-19 mitigation. So I can't be there on the ground and neither can any of the other local reporters you trust. So if something is happening, you are very much our eyes and ears. So please let us know what your concerns are so we can look into it for you.
That's right. And keep reading Emily's work in the Florida Times Union. She is their education reporter. It's vital information that every family out there with school-age children needs. So I encourage everyone to support the paper. Emily Block of the TU, great reporting as always. And thank you so much for your insights with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
A quick break and much more still ahead on the show. Now, later in the hour, we've got details on a virtual cocktail hour for women coming up this week that you won't want to miss. We'll tell you about that. But up next.
21 young people who are suing the federal government over climate change. And actually what they're challenging not is inaction by the government, but action to promote climate change.
They're just kids, but a group of them, including a child from Florida, are suing the government over its failure to stop climate change. We'll look at their case up next. We'll be right back.
President Trump has attacked his opponent's political record.
Joe Biden has been on the wrong side of history for 47 years.
Biden says four more years of Trump would mean chaos.
You are not safer in Donald Trump's America.
I'm Audie Cornish. Join us tonight for NPR's special live coverage of the first presidential debate, plus recaps and analysis tomorrow on Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tonight at 9 here on WJCT News 89.9.
I'm Marco Werman. PRI's The World brings you more than just a day's news.
Well, the poor old British pub has been around for 2,000 years.
We introduce you to people around the globe.
I'm a Liberian, but I'm part of Africa.
If we were only in Argentina.
I think it's a Scottish thing, you know? This sense of doom there, but it's always kind of amusing to us.
Join us and hear The World. Weekday afternoons at 3 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Robert Scott. I've been a sustaining supporter of WJCT for over 10 years now. I listen to WJCT all the time, and I have since I was a young adult. One of my favorite shows is actually a local show, and that's First Coast Connect. One of the great values, I think, is listeners are invited to call in. By the end of the hour, I'm definitely more informed about an issue. It's also made me think about it a lot deeper than I probably would have. This is WJCT News 89.9.
It's the biggest stories affecting the Sunshine State. Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup.
Each week at noon, we interview newsmakers and people from across the state discussing the stories and issues that affect your life. What's driving the conversation in Florida?
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Every Friday at noon on WJCT News 89.9. Well, it's a fascinating look at a group of young people across the U.S. who are taking on the government. About two dozen kids, including a child from Florida, are suing the U.S. over its failure to protect their futures from the ravages of climate change. In this lawsuit, the children are working to make the case that the government is responsible for the health and safety of its youngest citizens and that they have a viable place to live when they are adults. I learned more from author Lee Vanderloo. It's all in her new book, As the World Burns. Take a listen. Hi, Lee. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
With the wildfires out west, I think that what's happening with this youth climate lawsuit is more urgent, more impactful than ever, because we're seeing climate change happen in real time all around us right now. It's not something that's off in the future. It's happening now. Can you tell us about this lawsuit involving young people suing the government over their inaction on climate change and why you decided to write about it?
Yeah, sure. So the case is Giuliano versus the United States, and it was brought by 21 young people who are suing the federal government over climate change. And actually what they're challenging not is inaction by the government, but action to promote climate change by permitting and authorizing and subsidizing a fossil fuel energy system.
And who is Giuliano?
Giuliano is Kelsey Giuliano. She's the lead plaintiff, and she's an Oregonian.
So she's the lead plaintiff, but these are several dozen or a couple of dozen young people, it's my understanding, including some from the southeast, from the Florida part of the country, too. Is that right?
Yes, absolutely. So it's 21 young litigants, and the youngest is Levi Dreheim. He's from Florida.
So how did all of these young people, these young litigants, get together and find a way to sue the government over what they're saying is their threatened future?
You know, it's a combination of different paths. There has been state-level litigation over climate change through the same legal group, actually. And so that was a couple years underway before the federal case got started. And I think some of these litigants came forward and approached the attorneys on their own, wanting to be part of the litigation. Others were state-level plaintiffs in other cases. And some of these folks just know each other through their networks of being young climate activists and brought one another into further into the cause.
Okay. And so tell me a little bit more about the case these kids are trying to make.
They are arguing that the United States, through promoting a fossil fuel energy system, has violated their constitutional rights to essentially a livable planet, that they will grow up and face the consequences of a compromised environmental system because the United States is as dependent and promoting as it is of fossil fuels.
Right. And so this is something that young adults and children feel so much more urgently than their parents or grandparents, because they will be the ones who will suffer the worst impacts of climate change, as we know. What are some particulars in the complaint that you can talk about? Tell me about some of these kids and what they're arguing.
Yeah, well, your point about how much more urgent it is for them versus older people is really a strong one. You know, I went into this as a journalist, just covering it like I would cover any court case, and I was really taken with the perspective that these young litigants brought and getting to know them, and understanding really how deeply, deeply concerned they are about the world that they're going to inherit was really an impactful experience for me. To give you an example, the youngest plaintiff in the case, who is in Florida, he lives in the Satellite Beach area. So he's on a barrier island between the Atlantic and the Indian River Lagoon system. And he faces watching his community go underwater by 2050 is what the city expects will begin to compromise the community. Right now, he lives with conditions that a lot of people in the Southeast live with, which is, you know, the increasing wind intensity in hurricanes, increased windfall in hurricanes, and escalating intensity for tropical cyclones. He's been evacuated from his community three times, so far as I know, and actually that may not even be current if he was evacuated this year. I'm not sure of that. But he also, you know, he's an outdoor kid. He's very active in his environment, and he's always on the beach or at the lagoon. And these are areas that are critical habitat for nesting sea turtles and threatened manatees. And those impacts, those areas, both from rising sea level and erosion and also storms, really are beginning to impact these wild animals that are a big part of his life, and that's very hard on him.
Yeah. And you argue in the book that young people have every right to demand of their elders to ensure the future viability of this planet, which seems like a pretty obvious thing. But they're having to try to make this case in court. And so how difficult has that been?
It's been pretty tough. The case was filed in 2015, and both the Obama and Trump administrations have fought it. And one of the interesting things is to hear the government argue that, well, you know, this is a judicial overreach. I mean, essentially, the pushback is that the judiciary, the courts, don't have the power to tell the government what to do. And what the youth are asking for is they want a climate remediation plan. They're not asking for a very specific plan. They're just saying they want the courts to order the government to plan for climate change. The administrations both argue that that's too broad, that the judiciary doesn't have those powers to tell the government what to do. And so that's essentially the sticking point. But when the government has pushed back, interestingly, what they say is, if you don't like what's going on with the executive branch and you don't like how they make laws, well, you can just vote those people out of office. But we're talking about a group of litigants that is, some of them only barely old enough to vote. And many of the young people who are active in the climate movement, of course, don't have those rights yet. So it's kind of a catch-22. It's like, we understand that these are critical, important issues for young people, and yet the remedy that we're giving them is a path that isn't available to them.
So where does the case go from here?
Well, it's in an appeals process now. It was dismissed from the lower court by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals back in January of this year. Right now, the youth are arguing that they'd like to have the full Ninth Circuit hear their appeal, and they want to get back in the court and get back to trial.
We'll continue to follow it, and I want to thank you for your work on this. Lee Vanderloo, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Again, Lee's book is As the World Burns. In a moment, it's a virtual cocktail hour coming up tomorrow night that you won't want to miss. We'll tell you how you can be part of the party right from home. That's next.
Live from New York.
You're on mute? They tell you to get in costumes. I was in this, like, Spirit Halloween level Kim Jong-un costume on a Zoom, putting a light panel, like, 3 feet away. There was just so many moving parts.
Comedian Bowen Yang on SNL in a pandemic.
It was bad. Like the comedy suffered because of it. Yeah.
Next time on It's Been a Minute from NPR.
Saturday at noon on WJCT News 89.9.
I told you.
Snap judgment means your mother, your kids, the dog, and your boss are just going to have to wait until the story is over. Join me, Glenn Washington, for Snap Judgment.
Snap Judgment.
Storytelling with a beat. Do not miss it.
Saturday afternoon at 2 here on WJCT News 89.9.
This message is brought to you by the Florida Division of Emergency Management, Florida Public Media, and this radio station.
This is Craig Fugate, the former director of Florida Emergency Management. In this time of COVID, you need to update your hurricane preparedness plan. That means knowing what evacuation zone you live in, and if ordered to leave, you need to go. Take your pets and stay with family or friends, or at an inland hotel. Shelters are another option. Know your zone, know your home. For more information, go to floridastorms.org. That's floridastorms.org.
Joe Biden and Donald Trump both have strong opinions about China, and people in China have strong opinions about them.
Many Chinese will be following the first presidential debate, watching for clues about future U.S.-China relations. Some believe that the rise of China is unstoppable, no matter who is in the White House. How China sees the U.S. election, it's on the world.
This afternoon at 3, here on WJCT News 89.9.
Mothers in America already do more than their share of housework and childcare. Now, the pandemic has added managing virtual school to their already overflowing plates.
Now you've got to get everybody online, and what does the Wi-Fi look like, and is this encrypted, and is Zoom working today?
I'm Elsa Chang. How moms are, as always, figuring it out this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Starting at 4 on WJCT News 89.9.
Plans by the Trump administration to end this year's census early have been stalled. It's a new legal fight that further complicates efforts by officials to carry out their constitutional duty amid a pandemic, wildfires, and growing distrust of the government. Everyone should count. What happens when they don't? We'll figure that out next time on 1A.
Today, starting at 10 on WJCT News 89.9.
Well, we are all living in a virtual world these days, thanks to the COVID pandemic. But that doesn't mean you still can't attend events, socialize, and grow your network. A special cocktail event for Power Women is coming up tomorrow night. It's the She Is Fierce Women's Wednesdays. I learned more from Kelly Youngs, CEO of She Is Fierce, and CEO Letty Bozard of Bozard Ford in St. Augustine.
Kelly, Letty, good to talk to you. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having us.
So, Kelly, let's start with you. Tell us about the Women's Wednesdays virtual experience.
Okay. So, as you probably know, we have been doing our Women's Wednesdays live summer series in St. Augustine for the last 5 years. And every year they sell out. Every year they are packed with incredible, inspiring women. And we have these phenomenal speakers that come up on our stage. And so, of course, this summer we couldn't do that. And Letty, who is here with me, and I had so many conversations trying to figure out what is a way that we can still bring inspiration and positivity and something that we can all get excited about into our lives right now. And so the virtual experience is our solution to that, where we are still going to have inspiring speakers. We are going to do some new things like making cocktails and treats together. We will have a small group of speakers and presenters live all in-house together, and we're going to be broadcasting it to people's computers. But my hope and what we are trying to get people to do, and I know Letty will say the same thing, is encouraging people to have a little bubble party where you invite your best girlfriends or your mom or your sister or whoever you want to celebrate with, and actually broadcast it on your TV and join us and do a lot of the interactive activities in your own house together.
Ooh, Letty, that sounds fun. That sounds like a cool thing to do.
It does sound fun, and we're excited about the fun part of it. I mean, all of us, so many of us anyways, have figured out during the last 5 or 6 months that we really can do so many things virtually, right? And so we knew kind of from the beginning that we could reach people virtually, but the challenge was to find out how do we still make them or at least give them a little bit of a feeling of that which they used to experience when they came to the events, right? So instead of just saying, hey, we're going to get this amazing person and you're going to have access to them and you can sit in front of your TV or your phone, your computer and watch them, how do we bring in that feeling that they got when they walked into the event? How do we bring in the fun, that little bit of like, you know, putting the day away and really kind of being immersed in something that's like Kelly said, such positive vibes and a little bit being with other people, but obviously not promoting, you know, large groups. And so the people you were already comfortable with, we all naturally kind of found our family members, or maybe it's another family, your neighbor, but throughout the quarantine and beyond the quarantine, we started to kind of get back into the world, but they were your ones that you were comfortable with, you know, because you didn't want to be completely isolated. So Kelly's idea there was to go ahead and just get that group together. You're already comfortable and bring in some of the fun pieces and kind of try to bring our experience from our event into their home instead of, you know, at a location.
Okay, so with all of that said, how can people be part of this, Kelly?
Okay, so the easiest way they can actually sign up and get a free pass, but you do have to reserve a pass. We're not broadcasting it on Facebook. This is a totally different, it's not a Zoom call. It's like a completely different kind of virtual experience that we're trying to create. So they do have to sign up. It's sheisfiercehq.com/Wednesdays. And the tickets are free, so you can join us for free, which obviously most years you cannot do. But then we also have this option where people can actually buy a party box where we will send them ingredients for cocktails, ingredients for treats, and then a bunch of gifts. So beautiful journals. I think our first box has some necklaces in them and some other treats and gifts that I hope will make the fun of the experience a little bit more tangible. And just like Letty said, I think our goal is to bring the experience to your house, not just have a virtual event.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to seeing both of your faces there, Letty. And as Kelly mentioned, you're really supporting women leaders in this virtual space. And you are a female business leader in St. John's County. So this is a really easy spot for you to be in, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Everything that Kelly's worked on, and I toot her horn just a little bit, but everything that she's worked on has always lined up so well, especially the Women's Wednesday series and some of the other work that she does through She Is Fierce and the things that she brings to women to support them stepping into leadership roles. It's just something that really lines up with me and what I believe in. And I'm always, always proud for me and for Bozarth Ford Lincoln to kind of get behind those initiatives so that women can see other women doing it. You know, I'm not out there doing anything earth-shattering. I'm selling and servicing cars, you know. Mm-hmm. But I really love what I do. I love the leadership role I get to be in. And I love anything that we can do to let women see that and hopefully inspire them to do the same thing, you know, in whatever avenue that they have access to it in their world.
Well, Kelly Youngs, Letty Bozarth, thanks so much for being with us. We'll see you there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And a very happy birthday to Jason Schatz, husband of our fantastic producer, Heather Schatz. Have a great day, Jason. That's our show. Thanks for listening. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Josh Torres is show director. Our news director is Jessica Palumbo. And Bill Bortsfield is our digital editor. Keep those emails coming to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. You can catch our podcast later today, or our rebroadcast airs tonight at 8 o'clock. I'm Melissa Ross. Have a great Tuesday. We'll connect with you tomorrow at 9 a.m.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.